Okay, let's take your phone calls with Daniel Kovalik as we talk about his work, The Plot to Overthrow Venezuela. I got a few more questions. We'll get to you too next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Daniel Kovalik with us. Daniel, Iran, though, is playing a dirty game. They are, you know, financing terror groups, Hezbollah, Hamas. Why don't they stop doing that?
Well, I think they view what they're doing is very similar to what the U.S. does in the sense that, you know, they support groups that support them. And I think they feel under threat in the region. You know, Iran is surrounded by 17 different countries. If you look on a map, it's amazing, most of which are enemy countries. And but they have been, again, as I noted before, after 9/11 and after they helped fight the war on terror, they offered to negotiate issues such as supporting Hezbollah. And again, the U.S. did not even respond to them. So I think they are willing to talk about all those issues if the U.S. comes to the table to talk about them.
Would they also work things out with Israel?
I think they would be willing to do that.
That would be dramatic.
Yeah. Now, it's interesting. Can I, if I could just say something about Iran that most people would find interesting, and I didn't learn this until I actually visited Iran. You know, Iran has the second largest Jewish population in the Middle East, second
yes,
only,
they do. Absolutely.
Second only to Israel. They have 25,000 Jews who live in Iran.
Most of them were born there.
Yes, and they have a Jewish hospital in Tehran, which has received millions of dollars from the government.
And nobody harasses them.
That's right. They have synagogues. I visited a synagogue there. You know, I think Iran is not the, you know, the bugaboo that it's portrayed. I think it feels very threatened. But I think it's willing to deal with the West and with the United States and with Israel, you know, in return for some modicum of security.
That's a fair deal.
Yeah, I think so.
You know, for both sides, if they could recognize Israel's right to exist, and we can't deter on that, and Saudi Arabia has basically done that.
Yes. Well, and then Saudi Arabia is an interesting case, though, you know, because Saudi Arabia, meanwhile, you know, you talk about state sponsors of terrorism. I mean, Saudi Arabia has played dirty games in terms of supporting groups like ISIS.
Look where most of the terrorists came from 9/11, where they came from.
That's exactly right. And yet the U.S. has continued to partner with Saudi Arabia, continuing to sell arms to Saudi Arabia as it just decimates the country of Yemen, you know, which has the worst humanitarian crisis in the world. No one even disputes that because of the U.S. and UK-backed war there, you know, backing the Saudi war there. You know, so there's a lot of double standards at play here.
Here's another thing. Why aren't we working something out with Assad in Syria?
Well, that's another good question.
I mean, his father wasn't a Boy Scout. But, you know, this guy was he's not nearly as treacherous as his father was.
It's exactly right. He's, in fact, a medical doctor. And again, I think, you know, the plan, I think, was to topple Syria ultimately. That has not worked. Toppling Assad has not worked. I think ultimately.
But the country's decimated.
Yeah, it's been decimated. You know, the U.S. may have to, again, to deal with him because of the fact that he hasn't gone away as it was expected. But you ask a great question. I think Syria is a country the U.S. could get along with. And it's very interesting. If you look at Syria, for example, it's one of the few strong secular states in the Middle East. You would think the U.S. would like to deal with them, you know, instead of some type of theocracy, but, you know, we've shunned them for some time. So
there's a Christian church, Daniel, in Aleppo that has half my family records in there somewhere.
Yeah, well, it's interesting because, yeah, I mean, Syria is a multicultural, multi-religious state, and they've prided themselves on that. And again, they have a lot of backing from various Christian churches there. So it's one does have to scratch their head sometimes about what, you know, the U.S. has decided will be its friends and who will be its enemies.
Well, let's take some calls. Enjoy our listeners. They're the best. Let's go to Bill, truck driving in Oregon. Hey, Bill, get us started.
Hey, good evening. I just have two questions, and, they may have complex answers, but I agree with a lot of what you're saying in a general sense. But my questions are simply this. What do you have an opinion on the role of neocons and neoconservatism? Because you mentioned Elliot Abrams. And do you have a perspective on Donald Trump's role in all of this? Do you believe that Donald Trump is independent from the military-industrial complex or its influences?
All right, two interesting questions. Neocons and Donald Trump.
Yeah, Bill, thanks. Two great questions. So first of all, yes, we see the hand of the neocons. I mean, probably neocon number one, John Bolton, who's now the National Security Advisor. He is a neocon. He has been pushing for war in theaters like Iran and Venezuela. Trump has at times even said that. I think Trump said something like, yeah, well, John wants a war anywhere, you know. So we do see the hand of the neocons, who Trump was very critical of during his campaign, but we see them back in the White House making policy, possibly pushing Trump towards a war, for example, with Iran. So then it does – the next question that you had naturally follows from the first, and that is, what is Trump's role with the neocons? So first of all, one has to wonder, if he doesn't like the neocons, why did he appoint some like John Bolton, like Elliot Abrams? You know, and that I'm not certain of why he did that. He seems at times uncomfortable with them. You know, an interesting thing about your question, is Trump independent of the military-industrial complex? In the book that was done fairly recently by the guy from the Washington Post, not Bernstein, the other one, I'm forgetting his name. Help me out, George.
Woodward?
Bob Woodward did that book on Trump recently. And the one part that folks have not focused on is he talks in that book about how Trump tried to take on the generals, tried to take on people pushing us towards war. And that, you know, he may have lost that battle. So it is very interesting to ask ourselves, how much is the president of the United States independent?
He has shown some restraint, though.
I agree with that. And again, look, I mean, let me be clear, you know, my own biases. I didn't vote for Trump. I'm not a Republican. I a lot of things about Trump I don't like. But I will say this about him. He has shown restraint. You know, when apparently we had sent planes to bomb Iran recently after they shot down the unmanned drone, and Trump said,
you're going to kill people. He pulled it back.
Yeah, he says they shot down an unmanned drone. Why are we going to kill people? So, look, and I think when it comes to the president, I think there's always countervailing tensions and things pulling on him. I think we have to appeal to the president, whoever it is, to their better angels, and say, hey, we want more of that restraint.
And didn't Iran, by the way, say during that episode that there was also a plane full of military soldiers, U.S. soldiers, that they said they could have shot down, but they didn't?
But they didn't also, right. So they have shown restraint. So, look, I think those types of incidents certainly give me some hope, you know, that cooler heads
do prevail.
But again, I think it's up to us as citizens in a democracy to really make it clear that's what we want. We don't want another war, you know. And I think that there's somewhere in Trump who also doesn't want another war.
We're taking your calls with Dan Kovalik, his book, The Plot to Overthrow Venezuela. Let's go to Michael in Virginia Beach, Virginia. Hi, Michael.
Thank you so much, George. Dan Kovalik, I tuned in a little bit late. I'm sorry, George. Please spell your last name for me before I go to my question.
Well, I'll spell it for you. It's K-O-V-A-L-I-K, Kovalik.
Okay, thank you. I'm going to answer my own question because I think the audience would be better instructed to hear whatever contrast my answer, your answer might be to my answer. It's a very simple question, and I'll answer it. Who was the chief culprit in the Iran-Contra affair? Now, in your discussion with George, you already said that the Reagan campaign, he wasn't a government official at that time, the Reagan campaign interfered with the foreign policy of the Carter administration towards Iran. You said that the campaign convinced the Iranian outlaws to hold on to the hostages that they had from our U.S. embassy in Iran. Now, I never hear anyone except Hillary Clinton talk about the chief culprit in the Iran-Contra affair. You are willing to acknowledge the Ayatollah and that religious element, but I haven't heard you say anything about Jerry Falwell, the late Jerry Falwell, who opposed Jimmy Carter by anointing Ronald Reagan in August of 1980 at the National Religious Broadcasters Convention. Now, George would be interested to know this. They're the only person that I have heard on the American media is a guy, I don't even know where to get a hold of him, but he has apparently a very small radio program. His last name is spelled D-E-A-C-U-S, I believe, Dacus, pronounced Dacus, first name Steve. And he pointed out in the 2016 election that Jerry Falwell Jr. was probably instrumental in getting 30 million evangelicals to vote for Donald Trump, the man who went to Mexico, had a secret private meeting with the president of Mexico before he was even officially nominated as the Republican nominee. So I believe that we have a religious cabal in this country pulling the strings of our politics in a way that no one in the media but Steve Dacus is willing to deal with.
All right, let's get a little bit of your take on that, Dan.
Well, I certainly think, I mean, we do see the influence of the evangelical movement, for example, in supporting people like Reagan and certainly Trump. I mean, Trump is definitely seen by a number of evangelicals as someone actually anointed by God. You know, I mean, people, you know, some of the evangelical leaders say that. So clearly the evangelicals have a strong influence in the U.S. government and U.S. policy. You know, I hate to, you know, draw the conclusion that there's kind of a cabal running the show. I would just say that they're a very powerful voting bloc, and they do have a lot of influence. How much influence, certainly over the day-to-day, I really don't know, but you know, certainly that influence is there.
Daniel, do you see anything wrong with a candidate, not the meddling part, but a candidate for president meeting with governmental officials of other countries? I mean, to me, that's kind of smart politics, isn't it?
Yeah, well, yes, I agree with you. And I think, you know, again, one of the things with the Russiagate, you know, one of the allegations was that people like Mike Flynn during the transition period, you know, after Trump was elected, before he took office, was meeting with the Russian ambassador to the U.S., Kislyak. Again, that's just standard operating procedure. Of course you would do that. And candidates just running for president meet with foreign leaders all the time. And again, you know, there are restrictions on them, you know, doing.
Yeah, I mean, there's one thing saying hold the hostages until after the election. That's one thing. But there's, you know, if I were running for president, you know, I'd want Putin and the president of China and Kim Jong-un in North Korea to say, you know what, we can work with this guy. I mean, what's wrong with that?
Exactly. There's nothing wrong, and it's done all the time. And as you say, you want that to be done. You want your president to have relations with these people.
Absolutely. That's what you vote for them for.
Exactly.
Not to fight. Not nobody wants wars. My gosh.
Exactly.
Next up, what time is it? We've got time for a quick question with Cornelius in Louisiana. Hello there, Cornelius.
Hey there, George and Dan. Yeah, I was a military police officer right before the hostages got released, and our drill sergeants was getting us ready, Dan and George, to get over there and fight the war then. And it was just amazing because I was talking to Tommy about this. Now, Dan, this is one thing I don't understand. I don't know if you studied the history of communism. Communist China has killed more people. And you see in Hong Kong, they want to try to be free because they were under British control. And I understand that capitalism has cronies and stuff like that. If it was honest capitalism, these corporations wouldn't be running the things just like you're saying, pushing us toward war or something like that. But communist China, communist Russia, anytime you deal with communism, you're dealing with death and socialism. So I'd like to know what you think about that. And God bless you and thank you.
Well,
thank
thanks, you. Cornelius. And it's always good to hear from the state of Louisiana. You know, first of all, I mean, I just want to be clear, you know, when we're talking about Russia, for example, you know, that we're not talking about communist Russia because the Soviet Union collapsed in 1991. And I think we need to be reminded of that, that, you know, I don't view Russia as a communist or socialist country.
Well, not as communist as they were, that's for sure.
Well, or at all. I mean, I think that they have, you know, I think they're, you know, pretty much crony capitalism. China obviously is run by the Communist Party of China, but they're also very capitalist. So, I mean, they're very much a mixed economy. So that I don't see, you know, those, I don't see communism with a capital C being a threat to the United States. And again, I think pundits have tried to conflate current Russia with the Soviet Union to confuse people on that, to you know, encourage people to have antipathy towards Russia when it shouldn't be there. I think the question of the place of socialism in the world versus capitalism is way beyond what we can talk about tonight. But I think, you know, there are aspects of socialism that are very positive.
Dan, hold on. We're going to come back with final calls in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Well, next hour, we're going live down under to Australia to talk with Mary Rodwell about extraterrestrials and contacts. So make sure you're part of the program. And we'll be back in a moment with more final calls with Daniel Kovalik as we talk about his work, The Plot to Overthrow Venezuela. And welcome back to Coast, our final segment with Daniel Kovalik as we talk about his work, The Plot to Overthrow Venezuela. And as we were talking about speculating, Daniel, about what might happen, you think the Maduro government will live on, huh?
Well, I do. I do, at least in the short to medium term. But what that will mean, I'm not sure. You know, the sanctions continue to be ratcheted up by the Trump administration against Venezuela. Just yesterday, Trump announced a complete embargo against Venezuela.
That's
so
right.
All of Venezuelan assets in the U.S. are frozen. Businesses cannot do business with Venezuela. They're going to be denied and currently are being denied billions of dollars in revenue and monies that are actually theirs.
Well, don't they own all the Citgo gas stations in this country?
Well, they do. And so Sico is the Venezuelan-owned oil or gasoline company in the United States. But what Trump did earlier this year is he froze all Sico assets in the U.S. already. So, and that amounted to, at the time, I think something like $7 billion.
Are those stations still open, gas stations?
For the moment, but I don't know for how much longer because...
I mean, who's supplying them with gasoline?
Up till now, Venezuela, but they haven't been able to take any of the revenue back to the to Venezuela. And $5 billion of the $7 billion I mentioned was earmarked for medicine and food that Venezuela wanted to buy. So, I mean, basically, we're taking billions of dollars from them. The Bank of England has $1.5 billion in gold reserves of Venezuela. Venezuela asked for that back. You know, they have it like in a bank, right? And the bank said, no, we won't give it back to you. So they're really being squeezed. And now with this full embargo, I mean, it's going to cause a lot of suffering. Some experts believe, in fact, that it could create a famine in Venezuela. So, again, in the short to medium term, I think the government will survive. But in the meantime, these sanctions are going to cause a lot of suffering for the Venezuelan people.
There are surely some dictators or heads of state that are cruel and horrible. Is he one of them, Maduro?
I don't think so. I, if you look at what Chavez and Maduro were trying to do, and actually were very able to do in the first 15 years or so of their government, they did a successful job of eradicating poverty, extreme poverty. Even now, they continue to build homes for people in Venezuela, for the poor. They've built homes for about 10 million people, and that's out of a total population of 30 million. And frankly, if you compare Venezuela to its next-door neighbor, Colombia, which receives massive amounts of aid and military assistance from the United States, Colombia has a much worse human rights record. You know, in Colombia...
And all the cartels are there.
Well, the cartels have largely been wiped out, but you have these paramilitary groups now that are aligned with the military that are killing human rights leaders, labor leaders, indigenous leaders. Since the peace accords were signed with the left-wing guerrillas and the guerrillas laid down their arms, these paramilitary groups have killed 500 people. And this is in the last couple of years, 500 social leaders. And these killings continue. You hear nothing about this in the U.S. press. Meanwhile, Colombia has the largest internally displaced population on Earth at around 8 million, even more than in Syria. And these have been people who have been displaced by mostly by state forces in Colombia to take their land, and it's given largely to corporate interests, many of them U.S. and Canadian interests, oil companies, big agriculture, etc. Again, we never hear about that. We hear about people leaving Venezuela for Colombia. We rarely hear about the 5.8 million Colombians that live in Venezuela because they have fled violence there. So there's a lot of, again, double standards here, and there's a lot of information people just are not getting. And so they have a very skewed picture of what's happening in Venezuela and what's happening in the region. So they have no context for what's going on.
Let's go to Blair in Sedona, Arizona. Hi, Blair. Go ahead. Thanks for holding.
Thank you, George. Daniel, what are the politics of the current Central American nations that are supplying our immigrant asylum seekers to our borders currently?
Well, that's a great question. So first of all, the three main countries that are the source of migrants are El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras. I should note that Nicaragua is a country that is not, by and large, a source of significant numbers of migrants. It's a very stable country. And actually, the Sandinista government, who, you know, Reagan tried to overthrow, is actually in power there, and it's a fairly stable country. So the three countries are Honduras, Guatemala, and El Salvador. Honduras is being run by a post-coup government. People may recall that there was a coup d'etat against the democratically elected president there in 2009, which Hillary Clinton actually took credit for making sure he did not return to office in the hardcover version of her book, Hard Choices. In any case, so there is a very a militaristic government in power now in Honduras. And by the way, the current president is now under investigation by the U.S. Department of Justice for major drug trafficking.
Jeez.
So that's Honduras. El Salvador has, you know, had many years of war during the 1980s. They now have, you know, they've gone back and forth between, you know, fairly liberal left governments. They now have a more conservative government. And Guatemala is very similar. The problem in all three of those countries, particularly El Salvador and Guatemala, is the fact that the wars that were fought there during the 80s, in which the U.S. was very intimately involved in, and which killed a lot of people, about 200,000 people in Guatemala, 75,000 people in El Salvador. You know, those that the violence of those wars never end. It morphed into something else, into gang violence. And those countries have never rebounded since that time. And that's really what's leading
the immigration.
Exactly. And so people are talking about one way to deal with the immigration is a Marshall-type plan for Central America to try to deal with those issues, and I think that would make a lot of sense. And again, in the case of Honduras, people are fleeing a very repressive government that the U.S. frankly helped install in 2009.
What would happen if we took over Mexico as a state? We just said, look, this is what we're going to do. You're going to be the 51st state, and we're going to fix Mexico. Would that work?
I think it wouldn't work because the Mexicans would be very upset about that. I mean, I think Mexicans have a lot of pride in their country and in their independence. So I don't think that would work. I think, though, the U.S. could do a lot to help Mexico gain more stability. And I think a lot of it does go back to ending the drug war, these drug wars, which the U.S. has been backing for many years, which have really failed in these countries.
Oh, they've all failed. And one thing I think we should be doing, Dan, is legalizing drugs and making it easy for people to get some medical assistance.
Well, absolutely. You know, and when you look, for example, at marijuana, you know, now it's becoming legal in most states, and it probably will be legalized soon on a federal level. Meanwhile, look at all the harm that has been done, you know, when it's been illegal in terms of people who are still sitting in jail,
yeah,
you know, for having possessed or sold a little bit of marijuana. And meanwhile, it's now a luxury item. You know, we have to rethink our idea of drugs and stop looking at it at a war. As a war and start looking at it as a health issue.
A plant that this planet makes.
Absolutely. And that can be very beneficial for people if used, you know, properly and in the correct amounts.
Joe in Long Island, New York's with us. Hey, Joseph, go ahead.
Hi, Dan. I want to ask about both books. On the current book, can you give an idea as to how much oil reserves both Iran and Venezuela have separately as compared to, say, Iraq, which at one point they said had about 10% of the oil on the planet that you could actually get at. And also there's reports of non-state actors coming into Venezuela, such as Hezbollah, other cryptic type groups, having an influence, and the state doesn't necessarily have control of a place. On your first book, oil seems to play into that plot. Carter Page was supposedly offered a stake in Rosneft, an oil company in Russia, the biggest oil company in Russia, a 20% stake. Looks like Rosneft is about four times larger than Chevron. Chevron's list market value is about $240 million. How much is Rosneft worth, and how much was Carter Page offered?
Okay, well, I'll try to answer those questions the best I can. I may not be able to answer the last one. I'm not as familiar with that company as you are.
What I can say about Venezuela and Iran and the oil reserves is that they're quite substantial. Venezuela, recently it's been determined that Venezuela probably has the largest oil reserves on the planet.
Venezuela?
Yeah.
Jeez.
Even more than Saudi Arabia. That's no, absolutely right.
No wonder we've got our eyes on it.
Exactly. So that really makes Venezuela a huge prize. They also have huge gold reserves. Huge coltan reserves, and coltan is a metal that's used in computers and cell phones. So there's a lot at stake in Venezuela, and people have their eye on those resources. And Iran also has, again, is certainly in the top, several countries in the world in terms of oil reserves. So that's obviously a big motivating factor in both countries for what the U.S. is doing right now.
Do you still work with Tom Lyons at Skyhorse?
Yes, I absolutely do.
Tell him hello for me.
I absolutely will. He's a great guy, and they've been great to me. They've published all my books. I'm very grateful to them.
First-time caller, John in Lorain, Ohio. Hey, John, go ahead, sir.
Yes, you say we don't hear about these truths that you're talking about. I was really glad to read your first book, I think, The Plot to Control the World, which is even more comprehensive and contrasted all of the chicken feed propaganda in this Russiagate projection of the fake news that the U.S. corporate media is subjecting us to onto Russia. It seems to be the foreign policy of the United States propaganda. And I think that you pointed out that in Central America, we've overthrown governments, democratically elected governments, and supported fascist governments, death squad dictators that have killed hundreds of thousands of people in the most horrible way. And then that is completely erased from any of the discussions on the, I call it the CI media. You just look up CI prostitute media controlled by the CIA in a search, and you'll find out a lot of documentation for that. That leaves out the Washington connection behind this. And, of course, the reason why many of these people are fleeing those countries, we have a responsibility, I think, to treat them civilly and decently and to offer them asylum as a result of the fact that we have created those kinds of horror chambers in their own countries. And that is the targeted country now of Venezuela to do this. And this talk about, I've read some of your articles on globalresearch.ca, and we never hear any of these truths that you're bringing out. And it seems to me that the main enemy of the people in this country is what they know, think they know, but don't know that ain't so. And I think we have to really get other sources like globalresearch.ca and Info Clearhouse. It's the only places we're hearing it, and this is the rarity to hear it tonight. And I really want to commend you for having this on. But I was listening to the discussion in the Democratic Party debates, and it was just disgusting to see how they the establishment came out with their knives, the CI media, and people like Anderson Cooper. If you look him up, you'll just find out that he spent his summers at CI training courses at the Langley, Virginia massive complex. And he was just hectoring and badgering Tulsi Gabbard, the one person on all those non-choices that they were parading before us, who was trying to tell some of the truth about Syria and this.
Well, let's get a little reaction from Dan, because we only got a minute left, Daniel.
Yeah, so first of all, thank you very much for calling in. I appreciate all your comments. I agree with you that we need to know more about what the U.S. has done to create things like this migrant crisis. The U.S., particularly in Guatemala and El Salvador, supported a series of military dictatorships, which were brutal, which killed their own people. You have Elliot Abrams now in charge of Venezuela policy. He tried to cover up, for example, the El Mazote massacre in El Salvador, in which U.S.-backed forces in the period of a couple days killed 1,000 civilians in a very small area, mostly women and children. These were the type of governments the U.S. supported for many years. And so, of course, the result has been what we're seeing today, people fleeing those places.
Well, we got to bring it to the forefront, Dan, and thank you for doing what you do. Keep in touch with us on your next book, if you would. Up next, ET Time.